Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's medical podcast. Wow. I'm intense. I'm Dr. Mike Todorovic, and I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Matt Barton. How are you, Matt?
Is that just because you had a coffee?
I just had a coffee and a couple of shortbreads. So I've now pumped with sugar and caffeine. And today we're going to talk about – oh, stop doing that. People are going to switch off. Today we're talking about tissues. So not Kleenex tissues, Matthew, which you were thinking, but tissues of the body, the four tissue types of the body.
Okay.
Now, we know-
Important topic. It's usually at the front end of an A&P course.
That's true.
So I'm not sure why we're doing this, you know, 5 years into-
Because, Matthew, podcasts are not a sequential beast. Okay. People can listen to this podcast at the very beginning of their course, or they can listen to it at the very end, or they don't even need to listen to it at all, or they don't even need to be a student to listen to this.
Or they finished their course 4 years ago.
Exactly. This is a long time coming. You know, we could have done this or should have probably done this about 3 years ago, but you're right. Tissues are an important topic of conversation when it comes to biology. They usually sit at the front end of a biology course. And when we look at tissues, what we need to think about are the cells of the body. And when
how many cells in the body?
Individual cells or types of cells?
Individuals.
Around about 30 trillion. Okay. And around about 200 types of cells.
So what does that mean? So 30 trillion gets condensed into 200 groups?
That's right. 200 okay. groups by function.
What was the paper that was just recently released study they just released in terms of they've kind of quantified all the cell types in the body? Histologically.
I don't actually read every paper that's ever been published. So no, I don't know that paper. Please. Tell us.
That's about as much as I know.
Oh, you didn't read it either.
I just saw the headlines in, you know, one of those science alert, you know, databases.
And what did it say?
Basically, it was just saying that all the body cells have been quantified into groups in the body histologically.
Okay. And was it around about 200?
I don't believe so.
Oh, so I'm wrong.
No, I think that... I don't know how they actually did. I think they just looked at all the, you know, the main organs and, yeah, maybe organ systems and looked at the components with each organ system, and then they kind of, they had abilities to do certain histological markers where they could clearly, objectively measure these cells apart from each other.
Wow, that's interesting.
Kind of like an encyclopedia now for the body.
Histologically. Yeah, histologically, not functionally, histologically. Well, if you were to take the cells of the body and you were to group them functionally, That's how we get tissues.
Right. So basically what you've done is our 30 trillion cells in our body.
Yep.
You can then group them into 200 categories based on what similar functioning?
Yeah.
Okay. So things like nerve cells, muscle cells, bone cells, things like that.
Yep.
And then from those 200, you can further condense them into four groups of tissue. Is that right?
That's right. When they work together toward a similar function,
okay,
that group of cells forms a tissue.
Okay.
And there's four tissues. And so it'll make more sense, obviously, when we start to say what those four tissues are, which are epithelial tissue, connective tissue, muscle tissue, and nervous tissue. And so, for example, if we take nervous tissue, you know, you've got neurons, that's one cell type.
Yep.
You've got ependymal cells, that's another cell type, astrocytes.
So these are glia.
You know, they're all nervous cells, right? Mm. So you've got a whole bunch of different cells that perform different functions, but cumulatively together, they all have a similar function, which is for that of communication. And that is nervous tissue.
Right.
And the same thing goes when you look at epithelial cells. You know, there's different types of epithelial cells, but when they come together, they form barriers and boundaries of the body. With connective tissue, they come together. They hold things, bind things, anchor things. And when you've got muscle tissue, these cells come together to allow for work to be performed or movement to occur. And so that's how we broadly classify these four tissue types of the body.
Okay.
So I think what we should do is, because we've done an episode pretty much on each one of these tissues in depth, we should just do this as an introductory podcast.
We've done
a couple of nervous ones, couple muscle, haven't done epithelia.
Okay.
Haven't done connective.
Yeah.
But we will.
Yeah.
Okay. We will, listener. We will do a whole episode.
So basically what you're saying, we're not going to go into too much depth, but cover them in enough detail that it's a good introductory, not investigation, but
to be fair,
journey.
Yeah. It'll be probably enough for you to pass your exam. That's not a guarantee, by the way, but it probably would be enough. So I think let's start with the two that we've actually already done podcasts on, which is nervous tissue and muscle tissue. Okay. So I think let's start with nervous tissue. And so again, the nervous tissue, its job is for communication.
Okay.
And the communication it performs is high speed, very quick, very direct, point A to point B. It's obviously there's other tissues, there's other, regions, areas of the body like the endocrine
system. As communication.
Which is also communication.
Yep.
But the difference is that nervous system has nervous tissue like neurons and glia, for example, which allow for it to perform its function. And it's direct. It's fast.
Okay.
And so forth. So firstly, nervous tissue, the cell types within the nervous tissue, because all of these tissues will have specific cell types. Which help make it what it is. So we said neurons are the ones that send the signals.
Yep.
And then the glia.
Support them.
Is the, which means glue in Greek. They're the supporting cells for the neurons.
Okay.
What do you think we should tell the audience about? Now, the audience should know that we just do this off the top of our head. So
we have today anyway.
What do you think the audience needs to know about neurons and glia relevant to this tissue type?
So I think you've introduced it well. So nervous system, like you said, its function as a tissue is to communicate, because the cell, the body, the human body is, you know, it's a multicellular organism, and it's not like every cell is right next to each other. There's distances, particularly me compared to you, there's a lot longer distances to go from the brain to the foot, whereas yours is only two foot, whereas mine's 6 foot.
Wow, you got 6 feet. Wow.
So there is distance that you have to get information from and to. So that's its kind of overall function. Now, the cells, like you mentioned, can be broken into two, but let's start with probably the most important one out of the bunch. Is the neuron, which is the cell that is excitable. It sends the stimulus as electricity. I know you're going to pull me up with that because it's not true, right?
It's not true, but that's okay.
It's an electrochemical
change.
Is that fair?
Yeah, I always, because everyone always says, oh, we've got electricity coursing through our body, and we don't, and I've said it before, but it's not like a wire where you've got electrons playing hot potato, bumping into each other, going down the wire. Mm-hmm. A neuron.
It's just electrical chemical change across the membrane.
Yeah, ions like sodium and potassium and calcium and so forth are either jumping into or out of the cell.
Okay.
But they're doing it in a domino-like fashion that travels down the neuron, and that's the signal it sends. But that's by the by. You're right. Neurons are the ones that are sending the signal.
So let's say we wanted to move your quadricept.
Yeah.
You would have a neuron, and this is very simplified, but you would have a neuron, a motor neuron, that would originate in a part of your brain, the motor cortex, and that would send, this is the same cell, send a long projection of that cell all the way down, kind of the ballpark to your, you know, the end of your spinal cord, where it would then meet its other friend to continue this electrochemical.
What's the other friend?
Motor neuron 2, okay. Which we call the lower motor neuron.
Yeah.
Okay, so the way that it sends this signal is just by exchanging these ions all the way down this long one cell, which is quite fascinating really, isn't it? That's all done by one cell. And part of the way it does that is just on its membrane, because we know cells have this outer covering thing around it, and that's basically just changing the way that these ions move across it. Now, do we want to go into any more detail about the neuron itself? Was that kind
of? I think what we should say is obviously you got the neurons, that's the cell that performs all the activities when it comes to sending the signals, and those signals can go up or down. They can ascend up to the brain for it to make sense, or they can send it down, like you just said, for movement or activity. And then you've got all the supporting cells that help neurons. And so these supporting cells, like we alluded to, are called glia, and there's many different types. So you've got, depending on whether you're in the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system, you know, you've got Schwann cells, you've got oligodendrocytes, ependymal cells, astrocytes. Can you think of any others?
Should we quickly just mention
Mention
when they fit in along the process? Is that going too neuro?
No, I think because that's all we're going to finish on, and then we'll move on to muscle. So I think let's just start with the central nervous system, right? Yep. If you take a look at the glia of the central nervous system, you were saying that neuron needs to have a covering.
So a lot of that signal that's sent from the start of your brain down to the end of your spinal cord, most of the cell that is carrying that electrochemical change is on a part of the cell called the axon. Okay. And so that's a long distance it has to travel.
Mm.
Okay. So we need to try and make that speed super fast. And the way it does is you insulate it. Similar to, you know, power cords, they have that insulation around it so you don't lose the charge outside the wire. So it's in a kind of similar way to that. We have this outer fatty insulation that wraps around the axons. And in the central nervous system, it's done by oligodendrocytes.
Yep.
But in the peripheral nervous system, so this is outside the spinal cord brain, it's done by a different glia, which we call a Schwann cell.
So you've got neurons, obviously, all throughout the body, those in the central nervous system, which is brain and spinal cord, brainstem, spinal cord, and then peripheral nervous system, which are all the nerves that shoot out and away and shoot back into the brain, brainstem, and spinal cord. And you're saying that all of the nerves, regardless of central or peripheral, are surrounded by this myelin sheath, this coating.
They're axons. So that's
the axons are.
This is the carrying part of the signal.
So the axons are covered by it, but you're saying that the glia that create this covering are actually different from being in the central nervous system to the peripheral.
Yep.
Why are they different?
That's a good question.
Why don't oligodendrocytes wrap in the peripheral, and why don't Schwann cells wrap in the central?
I'm guessing it comes down to embryology. That would be my guess.
Mm. And you should know that. As the listeners know, you don't shut up about embryology. So,
well, I haven't had a chance to talk about it for a long time.
So
I don't actually know. It's a good
question. Schwann cells have a different embryological origin to oligodendrocytes?
Neurocrest cells, Schwann cells, oligodendrocytes.
Mesoderm?
You're testing me. No, I think it's neural tube, but I'm happy to be fact-checked.
It would have to be.
I'm happy to be fact-checked.
Due to embryology. Yeah. But regardless, take-home message here is that axons of the central nervous system covered by oligodendrocytes, and those of the peripheral are Schwann cells.
Yeah. Right? And An interesting difference here is when the nerve gets injured. So this is part of my research. If you get an injured nerve in the periphery, so let's say you were to cut a whole lot of axons in a nerve, let's say like a median nerve that's in your going down to your forearm. If you cut straight through that nerve and cut a whole, you know, 1,000 axons, if you can somehow repair it pretty well, the Schwann cells are actually got a good ability to allow those axons to regenerate and re-innovate, and you get back good function.
Okay.
But if you do the same in the spinal cord, just cut it, the oligodendrocytes, for whatever reason, aren't very efficient at allowing those axons to regenerate or go back to their targets. They kind of block it up, and therefore the outcome's terrible.
Interesting.
And that's where spinal cord injury generally has a much poorer outcome.
Do we know why?
Why they do that?
Yeah, so why is it okay to regenerate peripheral but not central?
You're asking tough questions.
These are the questions that people want to know, but is it a protective mechanism because centrally it's so important that if you have any incorrect or poor regeneration centrally, the deficits could be huge if it happened incorrectly. Right. So if you damaged a part of the brain, for example, and then you expect the regeneration to occur, yet the wiring buggers up, the potential downstream effects, if it didn't happen properly, would be significant. So it's probably safer to not regenerate and just rely on other neurons to take up the slack.
Right.
But peripherally, because these neurons are dedicated to certain muscles and sensory organs of the periphery, you have to regenerate. You can't rely on other neurons because they're so dispersed to pick up the slack. Does that make sense?
That's
how I've always thought the reason why that was the case.
Definitely the injury – we're going way off track a bit today, but that's all right. Definitely the injury at the injury site, when it's a peripheral nerve injury, it's definitely less complex when it comes to like the cells involved and what's happening. But whereas in a spinal cord injury, you know, it gets highly complicated.
Yeah.
You know, a whole lot of different cells come in. You know, you've got microglia, which we'll talk about. You've got astrocytes, then you've got all the immune cells, and it gets really
messy. Yeah,
literally. And that impedes its ability to regenerate. Whereas in comparison, I mean, Schwann cells actually do phagocytosing, whereas
– what does that mean? They eat
up debris, whereas I don't believe oligodendrocytes have that capacity.
Gotcha. Well, that's a big difference.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. It's a really good question. And when you compare it to – and this goes into our area of research. When you compare it to the area in the nose, which gets damaged every day, it has a very good ability to clean it up and repair it.
But are those neurons central nervous system neurons or peripheral nervous system?
Well, their projections is peripherally, but they would be sitting centrally, but their projections into the nasal mucosa.
So are they covered by Schwann cells or oligodendrocytes?
Well, they actually got a different type, which is the OECs.
Olfactory and sheathing cells.
Yeah, which comes from a brother of Schwann cells. So they come out of the neurocrest cell.
Okay, so a brother of a peripheral nervous system glia. Okay,
let's digress.
And
that again goes into our research, which we're looking at using those cells in spinal cord injury.
All right, I think we've digressed enough there. Because it's already 17 minutes into it, and this is supposed to be one of the quick ones that
That's okay. It's interesting.
It is. Look, the other glia that students need to be aware of, because it's part of the nervous tissue, so we do need to go through these glia, is let's keep talking centrally. So we said oligodendrocytes. Centrally, ependymal cells.
Yeah, so they kind of line the CSF, so the fluid part of your brain. So we have this fluid in our brain called cerebrospinal fluid that kind of bathes our central nervous system, makes it buoyant, so the brain's not heavy. It's like sitting in a bath and just floating around, like the brains in the in Futurama.
Oh yeah.
So they're in that kind of fluid, and that fluid's called CSF, but they probably move that along. They have got kind of cilia. They push it along.
But where is this? This is in the ventricles, right?
Ventricles, but also the aqueducts and so forth.
Where? So all the hollowed out portions of the brain,
and spinal
which
cord.
Would have been the center of the neural tube,
yeah. Correct. That's right. Well done. Well done.
So
that's
the way I
very
teach,
accurate.
Thank you, sir. The way I teach my students is, you know, you get an A4 piece of paper and you roll it up and you look through it, and looking through the middle of this A4 piece of
and
paper.
And that's Mike's lecture on embryology.
I'm like, the end. Well, this is my extent of embryological knowledge. The hollowed inside of this piece of paper is ultimately, throughout embryological development, going to create the ventricles and the cerebral aqueducts and so forth, all those hollowed out portions. And so lining that are the ependymal cells, and they take blood, plasma, filter it through whatever filtration process they use to then create cerebral spinal fluid that they then flush through.
So they make it tubes. Like in the choroid plexuses, and then they also push it through, yeah.
And the choroid plexuses are so it pushes it through to different layers of the meninges as well.
Yeah,
so you've got
that's just kind
the
like,
subarachnoid yeah. space yeah. is going to have cerebral spinal fluid in it as well. And so anyway, the point is ependymal cells, which are glia, produce cerebral spinal fluid.
Yep.
It helps, like you said, make the brain buoyant, washes away toxins, helps replenish metabolites, plays a really important
nutrients.
Role. All the important stuff. They found that mice that they didn't allow to sleep properly had volume changes of their cerebral spinal fluid, and they had a buildup of metabolites over time. So sleeping allows for you to create new cerebral spinal fluid and flush away these metabolites, and it is potentially one of the reasons why if you don't get enough sleep, you feel groggy because you've just accumulated metabolites that haven't been able to be washed away.
Right.
So that's ependymal cells. We've got microglia.
Which is kind of the best way to just to remember this. It's like an immune cell for the central nervous system.
Yeah.
So if there's infections or injuries, it will kind of come into the area.
We've got astrocytes.
So astrocytes are named because of their shape. They're shaped like a star. They've got arms and legs, not like our arms and legs, but
arms, legs, neck, armpits.
like their arms can grab onto blood vessels, and their other projections go into like synapses.
Why is it important that their arms grab onto blood vessels?
Well, I was going to get to that, but they help to form.
I thought you were dropping hints for me to sort of, you know, carry through to ask you the right questions.
They help to create what we call the barrier of the brain, the blood brain barrier.
Well, we actually call it the blood brain barrier. The BBB.
Or the triple B.
Triple B, yeah. The BB king.
So
the BBB king. BBB king.
This is a barrier that makes it
Barry.
It kind of separates the central nervous system from the rest of the body.
Yes.
Which can be a good thing, but also can be a difficult thing if you're like a pharmacological scientist and you come up with a new drug that you want to get in the brain, and it's a great drug, but it doesn't get into the brain. So it's non-successful.
And the reason why we've evolved that is important because everything we ingest gets into the bloodstream. Pretty much. And if it gets into the bloodstream, it means it gets to
– everywhere.
It exposes all the tissues of the body, including the brain. And if you've just ingested something toxic – now, obviously, we haven't evolved to ingest pharmaceuticals per se, but we've evolved to ingest drugs of some sort, and they may be beneficial or not, and they could be toxic or not or whatever it may be. But if they can cross the blood-brain barrier and damage the brain –
it's not
the brain's very sensitive.
It's not a very good outcome.
It's not a good outcome. Yeah. So luckily we've got astrocytes with their arms wrapping around the blood vessels of the central nervous system, and they help limit. They're one of three or four barriers in the central nervous system that help protect the brain from what's floating around in the blood.
Yep.
Okay. So that's
these
astrocytes.
So these astrocytes, you know, they play also a big role in regulating what's at the synapse. So neurotransmitters and any other ions and so forth. It's important for conduction and communication. So they're important in that role.
I call the astrocytes the you know when you watch the car racing, the Formula One.
Oh, like the pit stop.
Yeah, the pit crew. The pit crew, where the car is the neuron, right? It does seemingly all the work, but without the pit crew, it falls apart.
Okay.
And the same and the pit crew with the
microglia, that safety car.
no. Microglia once the race is over, it clears the roads.
No, when there's a crash.
Oh, yeah, it clears it all up.
They bring out the safety car, then someone has to clean it up.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, that's all right. Can we sort of extend this analogy for all the other types of glia? What are the ependymal cells? Fluid replenishment.
Don't know. I was going to say the – no, I'm done.
And the only other type of glia, and we're half an hour into the podcast, are the satellite cells.
So they're more wrapped around the cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system. And so when there is potentially
– sensory neurons specifically, right?
Or DRGs.
Yeah.
Because the dorsal root ganglia is they're outside.
Matt just loves to throw out initialisms and without telling people what they stand for.
So they are sensory cell bodies.
Okay.
The motor cell bodies are in the ventral horn, which is the central nervous system.
Okay.
Yep. Is that all the nervous it. Tissue?
Nervous tissue done.
So
done.
All those things we just mentioned play a role in essentially – the communication of the nervous system.
Yeah. Next is muscle.
Okay.
Muscle is another tissue made up of myocytes. So unlike neurons where there's a whole bunch of different cells, muscles have muscle cells called myocytes. But you've got subsets of these, like cardiomyocytes, for example, which are muscle cells within the heart. In actual fact, there's three different types of muscle in the body.
Okay.
So while you've got muscle as a tissue, there's three subtypes, and those are cardiac muscle,
yep.
skeletal muscle,
right.
and smooth muscle.
Okay.
And so I think we should just talk very briefly about each of these and what they do. But generally, muscle is there for movement.
Yeah.
Right? So muscle contracts.
Yeah. So muscle's ability or muscle tissue's ability is to lengthen, stretch, but then contract, which is shorten, and depending on these three types, they will do that in different ways, right? So skeletal muscle, which are muscles that are attached to our bones, skeleton, are very powerful in contraction, very dynamic,
yeah.
very rapid. Cardiac's also powerful, but they're probably more in rhythm, right?
Yes, and they're successful not due to their individual cells that contract, but due to the group of cells that contract.
And right? smooth muscles like me, weak, slow, but reliable.
Yeah, and found in my digestive tract. Yes, absolutely. And so the way I think about it is, like you said, all muscle cells need to contract, and it's the shortening of these cells that then leads to something moving, and it depends on what they're attached to and their orientation that yeah. depends on what's happening. So in the skeletal muscle, they're going to be attached to the skeleton, and therefore when you
via tendons, which we'll yep. get to, that's because that's connective tissue.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's attached to bones, which is also connective tissue, which we'll get to. But when that muscle shortens, it obviously will – now, muscles will attach to bones across a joint.
Yeah.
And so when a muscle shortens, it moves the bone across the joint and it changes the angle of that bone, and therefore movement occurs.
Yeah.
So skeletal muscle moves the skeleton, super simple, simply by that contraction.
So the orientation of the fibers are generally in long cylinders that are parallel to each other, right?
Yes.
So when they contract, they pull kind of in one
unidirectionally.
Direction.
Yeah. Exactly.
Unless it's a kind of a muscle that has branch points, but generally speaking, it's going to pull it in one direction.
But each one of those cells will pull unidirectionally. Yeah. Yeah. And so you compare this to let's compare this to smooth muscle, right? So smooth muscle lines our hollow organs, and so things like the digestive tract.
It doesn't line.
Well, it does.
It's in the walls.
Sure. Well, it depends on your definition of line.
Because I think line is better to say. Hollow organs are lined by
epithelium. Okay. Okay. Fair. It lines the internal walls of our hollow structures.
So walls. Yeah. Yep.
Like the digestive tract, the renal system. Pick a hollow tube in the body and there's going to be a muscle layer within that hollow tube.
Okay.
And so these fibers are usually orientated lengthways down the tube and around the tube as well. And so we call it longitudinal or circular. Right. And so the whole point of these two different types is that if you contract the longitudinal fibers that go the length of the tube, it shortens the tube.
Yep.
And then if you contract the circular muscles, it narrows the lumen or hollow inside or diameter of the tube. And if these two things happen together, what you end up getting is a shortening and narrowing and then an extension and dilation, and then it goes back and forth, and that leads to
kind of looks like a caterpillar walking.
Yes, it pushes things through. It's similar to putting a tennis ball in a stocking and then using your hand to squeeze that tennis ball up the stocking, right? And this is how we push fecal material through our digestive tract, push urine out of our
tennis ball
bladder. Yeah, with my hands and a pair of stockings. You know, so again, blood, moving through blood vessels and so forth, it's all because of this smooth muscle layer. Now, that smooth muscle is-
ureter.
I did say that.
Bile duct. And then if you have a stone in it-
Yes, it contracts around that.
And it's-
And that's not nice.
Apparently the most painful pain that you'll get.
Well, as a male, I don't want to say because I've never given birth and neither have you.
That's true.
So it could be not as bad.
But
as
I have heard- Many females who have given birth that say a gallstone is
worse,
way worse.
Okay, I'll leave that. I haven't experienced either, so I won't make a judgment there. Unlike you, so that's now smooth muscle contracts unconsciously, involuntarily,
yep.
Which is good because
and the fibers are perpendicular to each other, unlike parallel, like the skeletal. So they're going in different directions.
Yes, which is important because you need to contract around the object or thing that you're moving.
And part of the reason for all their weird orientations is why they are not striated, because they're not all lined up. So when you look down a microscope, they don't appear striated like skeletal or cardiac. They're smooth. And part of the reason is because they're all in different directions.
And the all in different directions that Matt's referring to are the protein subunits that actually contract. So obviously if they're all lined up in a row, you can see that down a microscope, and that leads to what's called striations, like tiger stripes. But if they're all in different directions, there's no consistent pattern to it, and so we call it smooth. Skeletal muscle is conscious contraction.
Yep.
So anytime you voluntarily move something, you know it's skeletal muscle, right? And that includes the diaphragm. So a lot of students will say to me, is the diaphragm skeletal muscle or smooth muscle? But it's skeletal muscle because you can control its contraction consciously.
Yep.
Right? All right. So we've done skeletal, we've done smooth. Let's go to cardio. So cardiomyocytes.
Oh, cardiac myocytes.
Heart muscle cells. So they're different in, now again, muscle cells all contract with the purpose of something to move.
Yep.
In this case, it's blood that it wants to move. And so it needs to contract around the blood. So the heart is going to be surrounded by this muscle. It's going to
muscle pump, be
filled. Yeah, it's a muscle pump. But the power of it isn't in the individual muscle cell or fiber like it is with skeletal muscle. Mm. It's actually the group of muscle cells working together as something that we call a syncytium.
Okay.
And so the way this works, unlike the other muscle cells, is that when you stimulate one muscle cell in the heart to contract, it actually is connected by these open doors to every other muscle cell in the heart and just propagates that signal to everyone. So when you stimulate one muscle cell, you stimulate all muscle cells, and that's the definition of a syncytium.
So how does it do that?
Because there's these open doors.
What are they called?
They're called gap junctions.
Okay.
And so remember, any muscle cell, they must contract by being depolarized, which means you've got to throw positive things into it, whether it's sodium or calcium or whatever, or magnesium, whatever it may be, you've got to throw a positive ion in and enough of it in to release calcium.
Yep.
And then once the calcium's released and you've got ATP present, the muscle will contract.
Yeah.
And so for skeletal muscle, you can do this and only a single muscle cell will contract, because there's no open doors that connects one muscle cell to the next to tell the next one to contract. You need an individual neuron to speak, or an individual neuronal synapse to speak to it to do that. But not with heart muscle. You can have a single neuron synapsing with a single muscle cell, and that can cause the whole heart to contract.
Right.
And this is one of the reasons why people can have what's called ectopic firing, where a part of the heart decides
to be the fastest though, right?
Sorry?
It has to be the fastest. Because isn't the heart kind of the pace of the heart generated by the fastest depolarizing cell? So that's kind of where you can get these irregular starting points where
– Well, I wouldn't say the fastest. It's just because certain cardiomyocytes in the heart are a little bit different and they spontaneously depolarize. So while other heart muscle cells need to be told to throw sodium in, right, to stimulate the contraction, other ones, the door for sodium is always left open.
Okay.
And sodium and calcium leak in to the cell. And so they're not necessarily the fastest. They're just always the first to depolarize because they reach a threshold first.
Okay.
Right? And so they're called the pacemaker cells. Okay. So they're always depolarizing, repolarizing in a patterned way. But you can have some cells of the heart that decide to depolarize themselves due to whatever reason it may be. And then that causes a part of the heart to start contracting before the pacemaker cells contract. Yeah. And then you're like...
Then you get arrhythmias.
That's right. You get arrhythmias. And then that's muscle cells. Muscle tissue, I should say.
Yeah. Okay.
Now we're looking at the two that we haven't actually focused any time on yet, but we will do an individual podcast on each.
And these are probably the most heavy going too in a way.
Yes. Well, they're the most abundant, but also probably... I think students probably find them the most difficult too because it's easy to comprehend what neurons do and easy to comprehend what muscles do, but connective tissue, because there's so many different types.
A lot of variety.
So firstly, let's define, what is connective tissue, Matt?
Well, I guess when you hear the term, you think it's to put things together.
Yeah.
But I don't think that does it justice because I think there's
no.
There's other stuff in there that does more than just connect. So for instance, you can have connective tissue that's structural, things like ligaments and cartilage and bone, but then you can have some that are immunological.
Mm.
So you've got a lot of your blood cells, particularly the white blood cells. But then you've also got red blood cells. I'm not sure where you fit that into. Mm. What would you categorize that as within the – anyway. And then you've got energy – things for energy. So you've got fat, which is a type of connective tissue.
Yeah.
But it's kind of this place where you just store molecules for another day.
Yes. So you've confused us even further. but the point that you're making is all those things don't connect.
They're not putting things together like, you know, say a tendon would.
Yes.
Puts a muscle to a bone, or a ligament puts bone to bone, or bone even, or cartilage between bones. But then you've got this fat, which is, I'm sure it plays important connective roles in some areas.
Well, this is the way I start all my lectures, by saying exactly what you say. So I go, it's easy to define nervous tissue.
Yeah.
It's easy to define muscle tissue. But connective tissue, it can be a solid.
Yep.
It could be a semi-solid. It could be a liquid.
Yeah.
You know, and they can all perform a different function.
Yeah.
So what the hell makes a connective tissue a connective tissue? And the thing is a couple of things. One, all connective tissue will wrap, bind, or anchor. That's the first thing. That's a broad definition of what they do. But the other thing is that all connective tissues are made up of cells, gels, and fibers.
Okay. Or to be more accurate, you could just say cells and extracellular matrix.
Yes.
Which is,
but it's not as easy to remember.
That's true.
That's why I say cells, gels, and fibers because it's sort of a little rhyming scheme which students. But the cells are obviously, you know, they're different. The gels are basically the extracellular matrix that the cells are embedded in and form the relative density of what that structure is. And the fibers are the things that are embedded in the extracellular matrix that will change the consistency of the tissue type as well.
Yeah.
So I always like to start with the cells.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Because, you know, you can have – so examples that Matt highlighted before of connective tissue include bone, so that's a solid, cartilage, that's a semi-solid, and blood, which is a liquid, right? Yep. But there's obviously other types, like, and you alluded to, you know, tendons and things like that, and fatty tissue and so forth. So if you have bone, then you got to think of that Latin or Greek prefix like osteo.
Yeah.
So you've got an osteocyte. Yeah. So that's the cell type,
yep.
At least the mature cell type for bone. Same for cartilage, chondrocyte, for fat, adipocyte, for blood if it's red adipocyte. Blood. Of course you would. You like to be contrarian. Erythrocyte for red blood cells.
Fibroblast.
And fibroblasts.
They're probably the most abundant.
Yes. Yeah. Well, fibroblasts, yes, because they make up all of those. When you think connective tissue, you probably think fibroblasts,
yeah.
The things that actually connect, that anchor the organs together. You know, you cut into the abdomen, you tear it open, you have a look, and you see the digestive system anchored to each other. That's going to be, you know, that dense, irregular connective tissue. You know, their fibroblasts are the main cell types for these types. So there's the cells, right? At least the mature cells, and there's obviously variations. So if you take bone, for example, which is its own conversation, we've had a whole topic, a whole podcast on bone, you can have, you know, osteogenic cells, osteoblasts, osteocytes. I wouldn't include osteoclast because it's a whole different-
Macrophage.
It's a macrophage, so it's not really part of this. But
probably is though.
Well, it's a whole different lineage.
Yeah, yeah.
While osteogenic cells are precursors to osteoblasts, which are precursors to osteocytes. But osteoclasts come in from elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, but they're probably a precursor from a, you know, an immune-like cell, which is still-
They are, yes, yeah. Exactly right. So anyway, so they're the cells.
But then you also have got the, you know, the hematopoietic stem cell, which is-
Yes.
A blood-making cell in the bone as well, don't you?
Yep, exactly. Mm. So they're the cells. Then when we look at the gels, which is the extracellular matrix, they're mainly just like proteins and sugars snapped together.
I think basically this is what is referred to as ground substance.
Yes.
And then most of that is water.
Mm.
But then it has a few other additional things like proteoglycans.
Yep.
And glycoproteins and stuff like that.
They're the two major types,
yeah.
Which always confuses students because you got glycoproteins and proteoglycans,
yeah.
Which is pretty much the same word, just flipped. but they are.
And this is where you get things like the thought of glucosamide, right? Where
yes.
It has a property within ground substance, which is in a type of connective tissue like a cartilage, which is semi-solid. Mm. It's got a lot of fluid in it. But there's no necessarily reason for, well, if you ingest a whole lot of this property in a ground substance, then miraculously your cartilages are going to rebuild.
Yeah.
Similar to, you know, people taking collagen in their diet to think it's going to make their skin, because, you know, there's collagen in your skin.
Well, we'll get to collagen because that's part of the next part.
But it doesn't necessarily work like that because, you know, you eat collagen, which, you know, have in food, but it's a protein which – you can't absorb collagen.
Mm.
You need to break it down into its building blocks, which is amino acids.
Mm.
And then that's just going to be put into your amino acid pool anyway, right?
That's right.
And then if you come to the point where you want to make collagen, it doesn't necessarily mean it comes from the collagen you ate. It's just going to be whatever the protein's been broken down from the amino acid.
Yeah. So with the ground substance, like you said, proteoglycans, glycoproteins and so forth, the way you should think about them, or at least the way I think about it, is that they're sort of like the substrate that the next part we're going to talk about, which are the fibers, the substrate for them to sort of bind to and help.
Or lubricate even.
Well, depending on what it is you're referring to. But if it's like bone and cartilage, for example, the ground substance allows for these fibers to sort of attach.
Right.
Right. And so that's the third.
So is the ground substance in the bone just the – like the salt, the calcium?
No. So you got salt? So when you look at bone, you've got the organics and the inorganics.
Yeah.
And so the organics are going to be what the cells secrete. So the osteoblasts that are building the bone, they secrete ground substance and the fibers, right? So the ground
collagen.
So it's sort of like the way I think about it is the osteoblasts are the builder,
yeah.
And they get the bricks out and they're the fibers. And then they get the mortar out or the concrete out, and that's the ground substance. And so they connect the bricks together by the ground substance.
Okay.
And that's and what they end up building is this wall, which is bone, right? When we look at the move past the ground substance and look at the fibers, there's three major fiber types. And Matt spoke about one, which is the collagen, reticular fibers, and elastic fibers.
Right.
And so collagen, tough, tensile strength is how you should think about it. Elastic fibers, you can stretch it and it snaps back to its original position. And then reticular is like a network, a mesh sort of network. Yeah. And if you think about all the squishy organs of the body, they're going to be pretty much filled with reticular fibers.
Yeah.
So if you think of the hardest structures, they're going to have collagen. Like bone and cartilage, just filled with collagen really. There's going to be some cartilage with elastic tissue, like your epiglottis and your ER and so forth. That's going to have a lot of elastic tissue. And then the reticular is going to be a lot of the dense, irregular, regular connective tissue of like the spleen and things like that.
Lymph nodes.
So think about if you were to get some jelly and you wanted to like aeroplane jelly. And you want and you make that jelly in a bowl and then you turn that bowl upside down and then you've got just this mound of jelly on a plate.
Mm.
If you were to pick that plate up and shake it, that jelly's going to wobble. And if you were to shake it significantly, it's going to fall apart. But if you were to get some little metal rods and embed it into the jelly while you're making it, which is going to be the collagen, it's going to make it stronger. Right? If you were to embed some elastic bands, which is the elastic fibers.
I think that's like... Yeah, you keep going.
If you embed elastic fibers, it would allow for it to be able to wobble significantly, but it's not going to fall apart. It just goes back to its normal position.
Yeah.
And if you were to embed things like feathers, for example, it's obviously going to change its structure as well. But that's what these fibers are doing. You embed them into the jelly or the ground substance to change its consistency. And if you embed a huge amount of collagen fibers, it becomes just really rigid and strong. Huge amount of elastic fibers, really stretchy. Huge amount of reticular fibers, it becomes like a meshwork.
Okay.
And that's how I think about it.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else in the connective tissue space that – an interesting side point is we've also got connective tissue that's can be graded in embryology as well. So the – these are called mesenchymal stem cells or mesenchymal tissue, and they come from the part of the embryo called the mesoderm. And so a lot of the connective tissue of the body comes out of this layer of the embryo. But interestingly, when we look at these cells in their early undifferentiated state, they have the ability to go down lineages depending on their physical environment. So if you – and we did a bit of this in our research where – if you were to get a mesenchymal stem cell or a kind of a precursor connective tissue and then put it under kind of tensile strain where you kind of – it's growing on a petri dish but then you stretch it in a particular cyclic way, it can kind of start differentiating to become like tendons or ligaments. So the physical environment, not only – because sometimes when we think of embryology, we think it's all
growth
factors, it's all the chemicals and growth factors, but changing the physical environment can also have an effect on the way the cell differentiates.
That is actually very cool.
Or even if you kind of throw fluid past it, so you have shear stress, it becomes more like endothelial tissue, which is what lines blood vessels.
That's very interesting. And I think when we look at that, you know, the cells that develop primarily from that mesenchyme that you were talking about, they usually develop five types of mature connective tissue, which is what we call loose connective tissue, dense connective tissue, cartilage, bone, and liquid connective tissues, and that's the blood and lymph, right? So they're the five major types of connective tissue. We haven't really spoken about, you know, loose connective tissue or anything like that, but I think
So that is loose, you would classify cartilage and fat kind of in there?
Areola and fat, okay. Mainly. Areola is one of the most widely distributed connective tissues. So it's obviously going to have collagen, elastic, reticular, you know, arranged in. We didn't talk about the arrangements of those fibers either because, for example, bone will have collagen arranged in a linear way, but cartilage, it's arranged in an irregular way. So for example, the loose connective tissues like the areola connective tissue I was saying, it's pretty much in and around like every body structure. It's like the packing material of the body. That's the areola connective tissue. Adipose is obviously the fat tissue.
Tissue would be if you eat chicken, you know, when you, take the skin off from the muscle,
yep.
That kind of spider-like
Yeah.
Connective tissue that kind of holds it together.
Yes, yes. That
would be an example of areola tissue.
Yeah.
Kind of the, you know, submucosal or dermis kind of connected in the epidermis, which is going to be epithelial tissue, which we'll talk about in a second, into the next layer. And that areola tissue is kind of that connective tissue layer.
Yeah, in the hypodermis.
Yeah.
Yeah. So of loose connective tissue, you've got areola, you've got adipose, and you've got reticular. So the adipose is fat, and it's there for energy storage, but also to protect things as well. And then the reticular is what we were saying before. So that fine interlocking or interlacing network filled with those reticular fibers. So think of like the liver, the spleen, the lymph nodes, for example. That's reticular connective tissue. So that's all under the loose connective tissue banner. Look at banner, Michael. And then we've got the dense connective tissues, which we hadn't spoken about either.
So that's got a lot of fibers in it, less ground substance.
Exactly right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. So, and there's so many different types of these. So you've got dense regular connective tissue. You've got dense irregular connective tissue. You've got elastic connective tissue, for example. So there's heaps of different types. Should we go through?
No, I think that's – when we do connective tissue on its own, we can go through the
okay, great.
Nuance.
Good, good, good. So, yeah, that's basically connective tissue.
So this leads us to our last one, which is the fourth and final. But that doesn't necessarily mean you would do this one fourth.
No.
I usually do this one first, to be honest.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So this is epithelial tissue. So this is the one that has the most cells in it out of the four of them. How do you want to classify this? Do you want to, so we sometimes classify this or categorize it by the way that it looks.
I'll have to shape. Do it by shape and layer.
Okay.
So first start with shape.
So this would be
Well, first let's define it. Let's define where you find epithelial tissue and general characteristics of it.
Okay. So epithelium, the term means upon nipple. That's what it actually means in definition.
Let's not get rude here, Matt.
I'm not sure what that actually means. Mm. I'm not sure where they got that from. No. I probably should have checked it actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the what's the word that means derived from?
Eponym.
Eponym. No. Etymology.
Yeah.
So that's what it means, but I really should have checked what it actually, the definition.
Well, you haven't just let yourself down, Matt. Everyone, you let us all down.
Everyone. So epithelial tissue is generally forms barriers. So it makes the outside of you. So that's going to be your skin.
So I'm looking at your epithelium right now.
Although what you look at is everything's dead.
How dare you?
So even though you look at my skin, it's cells that have died.
I didn't want to say anything, but I can tell.
So it's the body's surfaces. It lines the
So you're not just dead inside. You're also dead outside.
It lines cavities. So if you were to, like you were saying earlier, if you were to cut through and go into the abdomen, what lines the whole abdominal cavity would be epithelial tissue, or the pleural cavity or the pericardial cavities would be epithelial tissue. What makes glands? So these are secretory organs.
That's a Jeopardy question. What makes glands? Beep. Epithelial tissue. I wish we had a buzzer. No, we don't.
Or receptors. So this would be
really
interestingly part of the nervous system. But, you know, what are the things that transduce vision into kind of electrical activity? It's the rods and cones.
And they're epithelial?
They're epithelial.
Oh, okay.
Or taste, or the kind of cells with hairs on it in your cochlea.
Oof.
Or the proprioceptors in, you know, joints or skin, that pick up vibration. But they kind of do their thing, and then they change that kind of physicality into helping the electrical, electrochemical.
All right, so you're saying that epithelia separates boundaries of the body. That's how I see it. So anytime there's a cavity, it's lined by epithelia. So that might be the inside of your blood vessels or heart or pleural cavity or anywhere where you need to go from one environment to another, it's always going to be lined by epithelia. And that includes the external to the internal environment, hence why your skin is lined by epithelia, because it's separating out barriers of your body.
Mm.
And the outer layer is dead. You said that, right? Well, makes sense.
Well, the epidermis is what we're referring to here.
Okay.
The bottom layer of the epidermis is kind of well and truly alive.
But now we're talking specifically skin, not just epithelia. So the skin has epithelial cells. Well,
I just said epidermis, which is part of the skin, but the epidermis pretty much is all epithelial tissue. There's a few exceptions. But where these new cells are made is at the basal layer, and as they move up this epidermis, they die. And that's what you're seeing there.
So when we look at epithelial cells, they're really tightly packed. There's not much space between the cells, unlike connective tissue, where you could have like a bone cell, like an osteocyte, and the distance between it and another osteocyte could be significant. Mm. So there's heaps of space in between for that ground substance and fibers. But here it's not the case. It's just a cell connected to another cell, connected to another cell. And they're really tightly packed and there's no room for, you know, intercellular space.
There's usually three surfaces that we look at that we have.
And there's no room for blood vessels. So they're avascular. Yeah. Now let's talk about those, the surfaces.
So the surfaces of these epithelial cells, because they're usually in a plate of cells, there's the bottom layer.
What do you mean a plate of cells?
So I want to describe this.
Oh, I think just like if you were to take a couple of Lego blocks on a table and let's just say you wanted to make – you got a couple of Lego blocks and you made it three Lego blocks high on the table and five Lego blocks wide.
Yeah, just – you just line them up next to each other in a big long line.
So three high, five wide. Yep. The very top of that, what's that surface called? The one that's exposed to the atmosphere or the
one that's higher up is called the apical layer. Yep. And that in many cases has unique features on it for its function, which we'll get to. Then you have the basal layer, which is at the bottom.
The one's attached to the table.
And that's usually attached to the basement membrane, which is kind of the
connective tissue.
Going into connective tissue, that's right. And then you have the lateral surfaces is where it's bound to its neighbor. And like you said, it's usually very tight to hold it together, but also probably to stop things going between them.
Yes.
Or at least limit it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the three surfaces.
Okay.
And then the way we would kind of categorize is their appearance. So if we would first look at their morphology, their shape, and there's three kind of ways we would categorize the shape of the epithelial tissue. There's squamous, which is just flat. They've been squashed, so they almost look like they're run over by a truck.
Yeah.
There's cuboidal, shaped like a square.
Cube.
And then there's columnar, which is long and slender.
Like a column.
Like a column. Now,
squamous, squished, cuboidal, cube, columnar, column.
Usually speaking, their shape will have an effect on their function. So
yes.
The flat ones, because it's such a small diameter, not a diameter.
What's it's squished. There's nothing inside.
There's not much there.
The internal.
It means this is not always the case, but it makes it very easy for things to go across it, which we call diffusion. Mm. So things can cross it very easy. An example would be the type 1 pneumocytes in your lung or your alveoli are a squamous cell, and they're very thin, flat, which allows oxygen to cross very easy and to go into blood and carbon dioxide to come out of the blood to cross the alveoli to be breathed out. So that's nice for diffusion.
And it's squished, so it doesn't have any intracellular organelles or compartments or anything like that because it's dead, it's squished, and it wants things to get through. So what's the easiest way to get things through? Let's limit the volume or the distance which something needs to travel.
Yep.
But then that brings us to the next two, like the cuboidal.
Cuboidal.
What does that tell you? If it's shaped like a cube, it's got a significant amount of...
It's got more organelles in it.
That's right. So it's going to be doing stuff and producing stuff.
And some examples would be secreting things.
Yeah.
Or increasing the ability to absorb things.
Yep.
Okay, and sometimes through absorption.
Or both.
These cells can add additional appendages, which is kind of projections on
cilia or villi.
Yeah, or microvilli, which are kind of these
microvilli,
these things that just increase surface area. So you might see this, for instance, well, the columnar ones are usually ones you find in the gut and they increase the surface area.
Yes, I always think because the cuboidal and the columnar have quite a large intracellular area, the organelles are doing stuff and that's producing maybe enzymes or mucus ready for secretion.
Yeah.
So anytime you see a part of the body that's got cuboidal or columnar, think they're going to be secreting something. If they've got microvilli, which are fingertip-like projections on their surface, they're increasing their surface area. So that's there for absorption. So they also want to absorb something as well.
Yep.
I made the mistake of saying villi, and the difference is that microvilli are the projections on the apical surface of epithelia, but villi are simply epithelia themselves projecting out.
In kind of valleys and waves. And
exactly. So that's simply just by shape, but we haven't spoken about how many layers they can have. So they could be one layer or many layers, right?
So if it's one layer, it's simple. And again, example would be the alveoli cells.
Oh, yes, yes. Sir.
So that's a simple squamous cell.
Yeah. So simple means one layer.
Yeah. And that's usually there for that diffusion. It'd be a perfect cell for diffusion. Makes sense. But then you can stack them on top of each other like the Lego box, and you can put squamous on top of squamous on top of squamous, and that would be the epidermis on the skin.
Like creating a brick wall.
Like a brick wall. And that's going to be not so good for diffusion, but good for protection.
It makes total sense. You look at it and you go, oh, it's one squish layer. Things will easily get through that. Oh, that's exactly why it's there. So things can easily get through, like you said, like gases. And you go, oh, many layers of dead cells that are squished. Why is that? Well, it doesn't want things to get through because there's heaps of layers, but they're also dead and squished. So it doesn't matter if they get damaged and sloughed off and, you know, moved away. So it's there for areas of abrasion, like you said, like our epidermis.
And to add to that, we could use in that protection layer, because there's a lot of abrasion, you could add a protein to it, which we called keratin, and that can help with waterproofing.
Yeah.
And so with these protective layers where you get a lot of abrasion, your skin, they usually chuck keratin in it because you want to make your skin a bit waterproof. But you also get in abrasion areas, say in your mouth or your esophagus or the anus. And that's also got these stratified squamous, but they're always in water, so there's no point waterproofing them.
Mm.
So these are what we call non-keratinized stratified squamous.
There you go.
So it's still there for abrasion. So you're going to, especially you eat a lot of food that you don't chew. So
says you, Mr. Duck.
So you're going to lose a lot of cell layers. So you want to be able to replace them quickly.
Yeah.
So the non-keratinized stratified squamous would be mouth, top of esophagus, and then the
rectum. All right. So give us some others. Give us some other types. So you've said squamous is simple is one layer, stratified is many layers.
Yeah.
And we've given an example of simple squamous and stratified squamous. What are some other examples of epithelia and where we can find them? Again, form equals function.
Oh, okay, so you could have cuboidal layers that, like you said, secrete things, so enzymes or hormones.
Stratified.
A good example for this layer, for this location would be the pancreas, secreting enzymes into ducts. I believe they're simple cuboidal, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of, I should really know this. There's an interesting organ, the urinary bladder, that has a cell called transitional. So when the bladder is empty, they're probably more cuboidal or columnar shaped, but as the bladder fills and stretches, it changes the morphology into a squamous more.
Yeah, well, generally the apical surface is squamous, and as you move down to the basals, it goes to more cuboidal than columnar. And the changes in this cell shapes means that it itself can change shape as a whole tissue and distend and snap back like the bladder needs to, right, when it overfills. And you can also have – sorry, keep going.
And an interesting side one, which is a unique one, is what we call a pseudostratified
epithelium. Oh, that's what I was going to say.
And that looks like it should be stratified, but it's the way that the cells are actually positioned that they're kind of squashed in different ways. And if you look down a microscope, it kind of looks like they're stratified, but in fact they're only one layer thick.
Yeah.
And examples as the slated –
is that how you pronounce it? Ciliated, not ciliated.
Yeah, but you know how I pronounce things.
That's true.
Pseudostratified epithelium. Would you find, you know, in your respiratory tract, the top of your respiratory tract, which is important for things that shouldn't be in the air that you breathe, like pollen or dust or bacteria, it gets stuck and they have cilia which push it upwards into your pharynx and then you swallow or, in your case, spit it out in the ground.
So so when we get an exam in front of us and we see, you know, a question that says form equals function, where would you expect to find the following epithelia?
Yep.
It's pretty easy to do now. Simple, one layer. Things can get through if it's squished. If it's not, it's got intracellular compartment to be able to produce stuff, so secrete. If it's going to have microvilli, it's increasing surface area, therefore absorption. If it's cilia, they move like a motor, like, and they can beat and push things across. And you can even say like pseudostratified ciliated epithelia or pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelia. You can go, well, I know what that is now, right? So
increase absorption.
Well, it helps to throw things across.
Oh, sorry.
I was
thinking the microvilli one.
A lot of pseudostratified tissue, so you might be asking what's the benefit of that. A lot of pseudostratified tissue produces mucus. So just know that.
Does it produce it or is it the cell?
Well, the goblet cells that are dispersed between them have the space and room to be able to do that. So pseudostratified often has goblet cells dispersed for mucus secretion.
Mm.
And I think that's it, right?
Well, I've drank a whole bottle of water before this podcast, so I need to go and urinate. So my bladder would be
fully distended.
Distended, so it would be in its kind of squamous state.
You know what we could think about? We could say, okay, before you do that, what tissues are going to be utilized for you to empty that bladder? So you've got nervous innervation.
Which is telling me that I need to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
So it's firing at the moment going toilet.
Okay.
And so the bladder is kind of an organ with a whole lot of muscle in it's like a
muscular pouch, which was my nickname in high school.
I was going to say urine bag. But
okay, yeah, pee bag. So you got muscle, like the detrusor muscle.
But that would
the
be bladder. Smooth muscle.
Smooth muscle, ready to contract to help push this urine out.
Yep.
Then you've got the epithelial lining the inside, which is going to be that transitional to help it distend. And then connective tissue is going to be
It's interspersed, but there's also connective tissue on the outside, which is the serosa, to allow the organ to move in the pelvis without causing friction.
So what we've highlighted.
But also you've got, and this is interesting, well, I think it is.
Well, we'll be the judge of that.
The different nerves that innervate the bladder. So at the moment, I'm probably sitting in a parasympathetic state, and the parasympathetic nervous system, what it would do is it would cause the contraction for a lot of the detrusor muscle, but at the same time relax the sphincters of the pelvic floor. But if you had a sympathetic reaction. But this is interesting because it kind of
goes. Here we go, everyone.
But if you
sit back.
Technically, if you had a sympathetic reaction, which is a fight and flight,
yeah.
What it should do is it should clamp the sphincter closed.
That's the way to explain it.
And it should actually relax the neck of the bladder.
Right.
Okay. And you should hold on to it because, you know, you run away from bear.
Wouldn't relaxing the neck of the bladder increase the amount of urine coming out of the bladder?
No, I think it just takes the tension off.
Okay.
But. As you probably heard, when you get scared.
I urinate myself.
Yeah, you urinate yourself. So how does that work if you're having a fight and flight?
That's a rebound effect, isn't it?
Yeah. I think you have a very quick transient parasympathetic response.
I think it's a sympathetic rebound because I think what happens is, and this is an oversimplification, is that if you have this acute sympathetic response that your parasympathetic nervous system tries to counteract it and tries to respond itself to try and balance it out.
Right.
And then that can result in you either defecating or
urinating
yourself.
Yeah.
And for you, unfortunately, is both. at the same hole, the cloaca, generally. Like most turtles and birds.
That's great. You've listened to my comparative anatomy and embryology. Well done.
Which is a good place to finish, which is Matt's cloaca. So hopefully everybody enjoyed our four tissues. It was meant to be 30 minutes, a little bit over. That's okay. I think
it was interesting. Was it a lot of digression?
Yes.
But great.
That's what podcasts are about, mate. Everyone, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Dr. Mike Todorovic, joined by whoever this guy is, which is Dr. Matt Barton.
I'm off to the bathroom.
Great. Well, you can contact us once Matt's finished at the bathroom, of course, via email, gubiosciences@gmail.com, or you can watch our YouTube channel with over 500 free videos helping you pass your exams.
Is that actually true?
Yeah, over 500. Yeah. We're very good and prolific. And you can contact me on social media. I'm on all the good platforms. You decide what those ones are, at Dr. Mike Todorovic, at DrMiketodorovic. We have a monthly newsletter that we are beginning. Woohoo! So if you want to visit our website, Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike, no, wait a minute. It's just drmattdrmike.com.au.
The website?
That's the website. Okay. drmattdrmike.com.au. Dr. Bean DR. If you go to the website, it will then ask you to sign up to our newsletter. And every month we will give you updates as to when a new podcast is out, when a new video is out, and we'll have a little bit of some helpful tips on how to study, prepare for exams, how to remember things, and also just general info on how the body works. So feel free to sign up and we'll speak soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.